I'm pleased to introduce today Jonathan Trejo Matthes. He's an assistant professor of philosophy here at Boston College. His research interests lie in social and political philosophy, including questions of authority, obligation, and justice, moral philosophy in the Kantian tradition, and ethics and meta-ethics, and on Habermas and the Frankfurt School of Critical Social Theory. Recent scholarly articles, he's taken up the work of Jürgen Habermas, John Rawls, David Esslin, and Richard Rorty, among others. He received his PhD in philosophy from Northwestern University in 2009. He was a Fulbright Scholar in 2006 and 7 at the Goethe University of Frankfurt, and a postdoc at the Justitia Amplificata.
Justitia Amplificata, yeah, it's a German thing. I think in order to get a lot of big money for grants, you want to have it like with a fancy
name, fancy Latin name or something. Well, apologies for butchering it if you're out there listening at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Frankfurt in 2010. And he's also a member of the recently formed Global Justice Network. So please join me in welcoming Professor Trejo Matthes.
Thanks very much. I'd like to thank Alan and Eric for extending the invitation. I'm very honored to be able to present something to you here at the Boise Center. You guys really run a first-class operation in terms of these kinds of lunch things. It's really great. All the little details are taken care of. It's the best place to be a speaker. I'm not going to burden you with the reasons. I had a bit of a rough night last night, so if that shows at some point, please bear with me. My strategy is going to be to throw out perhaps an absurd number of ideas in a short space of time and let you guys ask for further clarification about things that are of interest to you.
Let me flip, actually.
Waiting for the slides to come up. There are two handouts, by the way, too, if you've come in. They're on the table. One of them has some quotations, and the other is a poem by Robert Pinsky, Boston's own Robert Pinsky. Okay, so the talk is Political Obligations in the World Society. I'll talk mainly about political obligations, and hopefully if there's time, say a little bit about the World Society concept. If I don't get to it, we can address that in question and answer. In the question and answer period, the 2Ks in communication, it's just the German way of spelling communication, and a lot of the figures that I'm inspired by are German, so if you're puzzled about that and think I have a spelling disorder, it's just the German way of spelling communication. So what is political obligation? It's not an ordinary term that we use in everyday language. You may never have even heard of this idea. In the philosophical literature, the standard way of defining political obligation is as a general defeasible duty to obey the law of one state or of the state of which one is a member or where one's residing. It's a defeasible duty because it could be overridden by various kinds of considerations. If there's a terribly unjust law or if it imposes unreasonable costs on you, then you might no longer have a duty to obey that particular law or that particular state. But if there is such a duty, what it means is that the very existence of a law introduces a new reason that you have to consider as a moral agent when deciding what to do in that particular situation. Simply because the law says do or don't do X, you now have a presumptively sufficient reason to do or not do X. The denial of that claim means that whatever the law says is completely irrelevant to your practical deliberation about what to do in a situation. In the literature, this tends to be called philosophical anarchism. It's philosophical because all it says is that the fact that there's a law that says do or don't do something is neither here nor there with respect to what you should think about the reasons that actually apply to you as a moral agent. It doesn't take the further step of political anarchism in saying that the very existence of states is a bad thing and we should take steps to eliminate them. So philosophical anarchism says you should just decide on a case-by-case basis how you should respond to the existence of this or that state or this or that law that a state offers to you. But the very fact that there is a state that has this law that it claims you ought to obey doesn't give you any specific reason to obey from a moral point of view. if you affirm the claim that there is a defeasible duty to obey the law, to do what the law says because the law says to do it, you can take a lot of different strategies. These are just various grounds that have been offered, different kinds of theories. And we can talk about those if you want in the Q&A. You can think that maybe that's an overly narrow way of thinking about political obligation. Maybe the notion of political obligation should include things like the whole array of obligations you might have as a citizen of a specific country. So you might have an obligation, for instance, to vote for the right reasons on the basis of a view about the common good, for instance, as opposed to trying to decide which party will introduce laws that are best for your bottom line, who will reduce your taxes the most or whatever, simply because you're concerned about having more money. Maybe there's an obligation politically that you have as a citizen to vote for other kinds of reasons. The widest notion is the one that by the end of the talk will have inched towards is simply what one ought politically to do, what one should do with respect to political issues. So I'll then talk about two broadly Kantian ways of thinking about political obligation, one of which I call foundationalist, and I'll say a little bit about what that means later. So this is the foundationalist Kantian story. It's basically Kant's story. And later I'll talk about a non-foundationalist story. If you look on the handout, page one is basically this Kantian argument. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through each section in great detail. But the basic argument is that there's this fundamental right of freedom that people have. And in order for that right to be respected in practice, it just has to be the case that there is a system of compulsory adjudication and enforcement that addresses disputes about purported violations of those rights. And I argue at all levels of political organization. Now, to flesh out that argument a little bit more, I'm just going to talk about what's quotation A on the first handout. Kant structures his legal and political philosophy in terms of three duties of right. The first one effectively just means when you interact with other human beings, you have to assert yourself as someone who has a right. You can't allow yourself to be treated as a mere means to the ends of others. And Kant says, as you see at the bottom of that passage, that duty is to be explained in terms of an obligation you have to respect humanity in your own person. So you are an instance of humanity. You can't allow humanity to be treated as a means in your own case. And he thinks that's tantamount to saying that in your interactions with others, if necessary, if you feel that you have been mistreated, you have to say something about that. And so, interestingly, that implies that the whole Kantian argument rests on a duty to self, which a lot of moderns feel uncomfortable with in some ways. But in his view, it's a duty of respect to humanity in your own person. Now, the duty of respect the duty to respect humanity in others pertains to that second duty of right. Don't wrong others. Don't violate the rights of others. And then there's a condition. Even if, to avoid wronging others, you have to avoid all association with other human beings. So you could comply with that sort of automatically by just never interacting with any other human beings. So you could never violate their rights. As it turns out, that's impossible. Why? Kant argues because the earth is spherical. It's impossible for human beings to completely and always avoid interaction with other human beings. We can't just continuously spread out on an infinite plane so that we never interact with each other. And if you have to associate with others, then you have a duty to enter a society, a legal and political order is what that is going to wind up meaning, in which what belongs to each can be, you know, secured to him or her against everyone else. That means there's a kind of public institutional order that settles in a way that, again, is credibly impartial, so not representing the specific view of either of the parties to the dispute. The reason why is because, for Kant, the real problem with not having such an institutional order is that whenever two parties have a different view about what justice requires, in the given case, or whether there was a rights violation or something like that, it's going to be the case that if their justice judgments conflict, they can't really retreat from them. Justice is not the kind of thing you can compromise about. And therefore, it will be an entirely contingent matter which view of justice triumphs in that situation. And in fact, in practice, the view that triumphs will be determined by which party has more power. And so in order for justice to be realized in our interactions with each other, we have to create some set of arrangements that credibly embodies a kind of public impartial view about what the content of our rights are in specific situations. The whole argument is in a nutshell in passage B, and again, just in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through the whole thing. However, I just want to point out, if you look at the passage B, I've emboldened and underlined three Latin phrases that Kant mentions in the argument, and they correspond exactly to these three basic duties of right. And in this passage B, you see that the additional aspect of his argument has to do with claims to land. He thinks that for conceptual reasons, the first kind of external right that has to be claimed, that goes beyond just our right of freedom, our right not to be manipulated by others directly as means to their ends, must be a claim to land, because we're embodied beings, and if we don't claim land, we can't claim any other kinds of objects. And I'm not going to go into all of the details, we can talk about them in the Q&A if you want to. But because we're embodied beings, because the earth is a sphere, we both inherently have to claim some right to inhabit a certain portion of the earth's surface, and we cannot permanently avoid interaction with each other. Therefore, we can't avoid wronging others, which we would do if we were trying to impose our view of justice unilaterally on them. There's an additional wrinkle in that before there are public institutions, he nevertheless says it has to be possible for people to claim land. So he has to solve this problem of, if you have to claim land, but there's not yet a set of public institutions, you haven't yet entered into some kind of a society, what do you do? And he argues you can unilaterally claim to impose constraints on other human beings by saying, this is my land, I hereby constrain all other human beings in the world from using my property without my consent. And his question, that seems really odd. How do you get the authority to do that unilaterally? And he says, well, he has various reasons for why that has to be provisionally possible. And this is what he says at the bottom of the passage on B. There's a provisional acquisition of land with all of the legal consequences is possible, so long as it's a claim, a condition that's leading to what he calls not a condition of provisional right, but a peremptory condition of right. So there's a kind of retroactive validation of property rights once we have a public institution. Now, my claim is that there's a kind of cosmopolitan implication here that relates to territorial disputes between states, because they're quite analogous to problems that will arise when there's a conflict about who owns what piece of land and with what right. So that the rightfulness of state claims to territory is similarly provisional from a Kantian standpoint, until all such disputes are related to compulsory adjudication. Compulsory adjudication, I should say, also just means that when there's a dispute between two parties, it's not optional for both of them to appear in court. So in a well-functioning legal system, somebody starts a legal dispute with you, you receive a summons to court or a subpoena or something like that. You can't write back, yeah, no thanks, there's a Patriots game that afternoon. You know, I have better things to do. You have to appear. You're bound to appear. So that's the idea. There would be some kind of adjudication mechanism at the global level that states would not be optional for them. So an example of what I mean here is, a perfect example is the U.S.-Mexico War of 1846. Basically, in 1845, the inhabitants of this part of Texas declare independence from Mexico. The United States, recognizing this claim, also recognized a claim to the independence of this territory. Mexico only recognize the Declaration of Independence to this boundary. So this whole red area was disputed. Mexico claimed it as its territory. The United States claimed it as its territory. Now, President Polk wanted a war with Mexico because he believed in manifest destiny, that it was the mission of the United States to expand westward. And so what he did was he sent troops into the disputed area. And then when the Mexican troops were more or less provoked by what they saw was an intrusion into their territory, killed 7 to 11 Americans, Polk addresses Congress and he says, "American blood has been shed on American soil," asserting his administration's view of the rights claims of the United States. Of course, from the Mexican point of view, they were defending their territory. There's no way to adjudicate this dispute outside of war. That's a problem from the Kantian point of view, and it's exactly equivalent to the problem among individuals. So that's the sort of Kantian foundationless story. You start with these very basic kind of moral ideas, and you try and tell some story that goes all the way to, you know, the global level. It's foundationless roughly because of this idea. A lot of the political obligation theories that you see express the notion that justification of political institutions or justifications of fundamental political claims must recur to or rest on something that is pre-political, external, prior, more fundamental than, more basic than the political, maybe even the social. So some of you may know about Hobbes' argument about the social contract. You start with an image of individuals in a state of nature that don't have any kinds of social relationships with each other, and you try and tell a story about how, just on the basis of their individual interests in survival and having a decent life, they would have reason to come together and create a state. So it's a sort of entirely pre-social, pre-political, it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's more or less true in the case of Hobbes, kind of justification. We can talk a little bit more about the whole issue of foundationalism if you're interested in the Q&A. But another way to explain this, and for me, I think the more problematic one is a distinction between the moral and the political that a lot of philosophers make when they're arguing about the very, you know, the possibility that there might not even be any right to exist of states. So this is a claim by the most famous philosophical anarchist in the literature right now, A.J. Simmons. And he's talking about modern states, and he means that claim to include, the CD there stands for constitutional democratic, to include modern constitutional democratic states too. And his claim is, the mere fact that an action is legally required or that a stable government holds power within a reasonably just state is insufficient to establish a moral presumption in favor of legal compliance. And again, there's this notion, there's a specific kind of presumption that you're looking for. It's not a political one, it's some other kind of presumption, a moral one. And so I just invite you to consider a possible kind of parallel with respect to another kind of modern institution, and a kind of parallel to anarchism, a kind of skepticism with respect to beliefs, as opposed to kinds of actions that we might need to do. So imagine if someone said the mere fact that a belief is scientifically endorsed or that a recognized group of researchers investigates such matters within a reasonably epistemically favorable institution, that is an institution that's favorable to the acquisition of knowledge, is insufficient to establish a presumption in favor of deferring to what they say you should believe on the matter that they're investigating. So an example might be climate change. So it might be this is perhaps a sort of distressingly widespread stance among some Americans. They seem to hold that kind of a view about climate science and the community of climate scientists. So that if the vast majority of climate scientists say we ought to believe such and such about the factors leading to climate change, that gives one no real presumption that you should accept that claim. And the non-foundationalist view basically wants to draw a similar kind of moral from both of these cases. both modern constitutional democratic states and the institutions and practices that constitute modern science are things that should be judged historically and comparatively with respect to alternatives that we know about, not necessarily imaginary alternatives or alternatives that philosophers cook up. Another way of putting this non-foundationalist alternative would be to say that political practices, like scientific ones, are rational, if at all, not because they have some intuitive, clear foundation, but because they are self-correcting enterprises, which can put any claim in jeopardy, though not all at once. Another way of thinking about what that means is that they institutionalize two things simultaneously. On the one hand, they institutionalize the possibility to challenge and criticize and contest whatever is taken to be authoritative at a given moment in the practice of the institution. And on the other hand, they have a clear identifiable rule for identifying things that do have that authoritative status, things that count as a kind of default position, things that can be taken for granted. And anything that is taken for granted at one moment can come into question, but you can't call into question everything at once. This comes from a philosopher named Wilfred Sellers, this basic idea. Now, if you think about political justification, thinking about political institutions and political obligations in that light, then you want to think about where various kinds of institutional forms, institutional arrangements come from, how they've emerged, what the historical and social process was that led to them. And so then Habermas is my example of a kind of Kantian who can plausibly be read as offering a non-foundationalist alternative. Basically, okay, social evolution is like one of those terms nowadays. It's like you throw out a live grenade into the audience and just wait to see if somebody's going to throw it back at you. But the basic idea for Habermas here is the notion of a learning process. And he thinks that it's relatively uncontroversial to say that in the material or instrumental dimension, societies, in certain societies, have become more powerful. They've developed technology that allows them to do more and more things, or they've accumulated more and more wealth. And power and money are famously, going all the way back to Aristotle, considered to be things that are inherently means to other ends. That's what it means to say that certain societies have demonstrably increased their capacities to achieve certain kinds of ends. They've increased their powers through science, technology, economic development, and so on. Habermas thinks that there's also a similar kind of learning that has gone on in the normative dimension. So basically, we've learned something morally, politically, and so on in history. And his claim there is that this learning is driven by the expansion of open public communication and argument in the social process. And a way of thinking about what expansion there means is just that more and more topics become available as topics of debate. There aren't as many taboos or topics that you just cannot talk about because some institution will sort of bring the hammer down and say, we're not talking about that. More people and more people of different social categories are included in a social public communication. They can raise their voice, they can say something, say, hey, hold on a second. Wait, why do we do things like that? I disagree. And the number of ways that people are included, whether it's through the media, whether it's through various kinds of institutional roles, different social spaces, also increases. And then again, we can talk about this in the Q&A if you want, because I'm kind of running out of time. He argues that there's a kind of directional bias in the evolution of normative learning towards more egalitarian kinds of ideas that comes from structural features of language, in particular the way in which roles in language are in principle, reversible. So when you learn the use of personal pronouns, you learn also in principle how to understand the other person's point of view in order to understand what it means when you go from I to you or you refer to people in the third person. And also he thinks the linguistic meaning is inherently connected to justification. I'll just throw that out there, but what it means is if language is crucial for the reproduction of society and understanding what someone says is inherently related to understanding the reasons why they might say that or the reasons they could use to justify it, it means that it's inherent in social reproduction that one can be liable to justify what one is doing. This, I think, allows for a connection with a model of political responsibility that Iris Marion Young has developed that she calls a social connection model. There's a passage on the reverse side of the handout, passage D, where she talks about broad social processes in which you can be involved. I'm not going to, you know, read them because of time. But basically, she wants to distinguish a notion of responsibility from a notion of liability, where liability is like what happens in tort law. It's when one identifiable agent commits a wrong or a harm or damages the interest of some other identifiable agent at a specific place and time, and then has to sort of owe damages or compensation or something like that. It's more backward-looking. You have to identify when the wrong was committed in the past, the specific people, and so on. Responsibility comes from participating in the maintenance of very, very large-scale, complex social processes that harm people, create domination, prevent the development of basic capacities of some individuals. But the responsibility here is more forward-looking, and everyone who's involved in the process has a certain kind of responsibility with respect to what's going on. Liability is not replaced. You can also ask about the liability of different people in the process with respect to different kinds of things. But people's responsibility will vary according to some different parameters, how much power the person has within the process, what interests they have at stake in the process, how much privilege they have, and so on. And I just add to her model an understanding of different kinds of connections that we might have. One of them is simply causal. So you're somehow causally implicated in the process. Another is what I call historical genealogical. There really it has more to do with meaning, understanding the kind of relationship that's at issue. And the main example I'll use is a sweatshop. This is a term that kind of came into being in the 19th century, but it's proved to be incredibly resilient across centuries in widely different parts of the world. And I think it's sort of part of the social memory. And that's a kind of social connection. And I'll give an example of that as well. It's partly in the Robert Pinsky poem, and I'll talk about two instances of terrible things that happened in the apparel industry. Another example is so-called dead peasant insurance policies that corporations sometimes take out on especially lower-level employees. Sometimes higher-level employees are very valuable. But it's very interesting that these insurance policies, which allow corporations to get some money back for the death of some of their employees, and oftentimes the employees don't know that the companies have taken out these policies on them, were almost sort of spontaneously described by the people who were using them, using this term from feudalism, you know, peasant. They're dead peasants. And a lot of these folks, these management types who were doing this, presumably weren't necessarily experts on medieval history. But there's a kind of historical social connection there. Now, the last one I would imagine is kind of obvious, of actual institutions, laws, and rules that connect us. So the first example from the history of sweatshops is the Triangle Factory. This is the Triangle Factory in 1911. This is mostly young immigrant girls in New York making certain garments that were very popular for large middle-class consumer public. They worked up on the 8th and 9th floor, but they were locked in. It's a very common practice. So they locked the doors, ostensibly to prevent the employees from taking the goods, and probably also to prevent union organizers from coming in through the back door to try and organize. There was a fire. Because the doors were locked, many people died. The only way they had to get out was by jumping out of the 9th door window, and 145 people died. These are images of the young women, some of the young women who jumped out of the window and died when they hit the sidewalk.
and people looking up and watching others jump down. Now flash forward 100 years. 2013, this year, April 24th, this is the Rana Plaza building in Dhaka, Bangladesh. The building collapsed, totally shoddy construction, violated all kinds of building codes, but nobody cared because these people were treated as disposable by the broader social process. Sorry, we just had lunch, but these are images from the building, mostly, again, young women. Quite extraordinary picture, people sort of trying to help each other in the midst of a terrible disaster. I want you to also just take a look at the buildings. These are obviously buildings that are totally utilitarian. They're just about what's utterly necessary in order to get some profit from the production process. You notice there's no facade even on many of the buildings. Now you can contrast this with this marvelous building, which is the headquarters of the garment firm association in Bangladesh. Probably the most powerful sort of business association in Bangladesh. The this article, if you read it, you find out that the Supreme Court of Bangladesh said that the construction of that building was illegal, land had been illegally obtained, erected without proper approvals, threatened the drainage system of the capital. It was, quote, a scam of abysmal proportions. The Supreme Court says you got to demolish this building in 90 days. 2 years later, it's still standing. And so looking at it from the outside, you might want to take the liability model and say, oh, well, I mean, it's the state officials who aren't enforcing the law. It's all their fault. But obviously, there's a broader process going on that's empowering those agents locally to act with that kind of impunity and to dominate others in the national political system. So this is an example of one of those connections. So Benetton admits occasionally having clothes manufactured at that building. Now, what occasionally means is that one order was 25,000 pieces of clothing, another order was 46,000 pieces. So it's not like every once in a while they, you know, sent out for a couple boxes of clothes. Okay, I think I'll maybe skip the World Society, but well, I'll basically just say very quickly, one of the reasons why I use the World Society concept is that typically the society concept has meant more or less nation-state society. And partly explains some of Kant's own hesitation. So Kant, for instance, I made this claim that there's this totally cosmopolitan implication of Kant's view, but actually there's a lot of debate about that in the literature. Kant sometimes seems to have said all that's necessary is some kind of voluntary sort of agreement by states to get together and talk when they have issues. On the other hand, he sometimes seems to say there's a stronger ideal. And I think part of his hesitation is, again, a certain hesitation about where you apply the society concept. To see where what's ruled out by using the World Society concept is to rule out the realist idea that at the global level there's just an international system of states. The relationships between the states are anarchical. It's just another way of saying there's no society aspect, no societal aspect. There's a view that starts to sort of approach the World Society aspect. The English school, we can talk about that if you want. But basically, the basis for claiming that the only non-arbitrary level at which to apply the society concept, the unqualified society concept, for various purposes, you can qualify it, you know, German society, you know, Italian society, but as a fundamental theoretical concept, the only non-arbitrary place to apply the society concept, so the argument goes, is at the global level at this point. It's partly empirical, but partly conceptual. It's because the interconnections in terms of communication, meaningful events that involve social interaction between human beings now have a kind of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon effect, where from any given instance of communicative interaction, you could eventually draw lines to just about every other. Now, there's a spectrum. Some people aren't, you know, people are more or less included in this kind of communicative network of world society, but we've reached a threshold at which I think arguably you could say it exists. And that's roughly, I think, what Kant was already starting to get at when he said in this famous line from Perpetual Peace, we've reached a point at which the violation of rights in one part of the earth is felt everywhere. Yeah. Okay, I want to say briefly before we go to the Q&A that another way of thinking about what it means concretely for us as individuals to think about our social connections in this model of political responsibility is Robert Pinsky's wonderful poem called The Shirt, where he starts off talking about a shirt that he has and uses all sorts of very technical terms for parts of shirts and parts of the machines that make shirts. Very quickly, reflects on the production of the shirt by Koreans or Malaysians, he says, in a sweatshop. And then, after further sort of recitation of parts of the machines, wanders backwards historically and meditates on the triangle factory and makes that connection between things that are going on in a distant part of the world now and things that happened in our part of the world back then. And he has these wonderful lines about imagining what it was like for the employees in the triangle factory to face the fate that they did. And just to also make it even more concrete, this shirt was made in Bangladesh. It could very well have possibly been made at that building. That's it.
All right, well, thank you very much.